Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates, I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. Today we're talking about gene-edited crops. For decades, there's been a fiery debate around genetic modification. It's seen by many as a solution to some of the world's biggest food problems, but by others as a reckless scientific gamble endangering human health and the environment. In the 1990s and 2000s, GM trial crops in East Anglia were trashed by protesters, with farmers defending them using tractors as battering rams. But are these technologies just another step in the perpetual agricultural revolution that's been transforming our relationship with food ever since our hunter-gatherer ancestors discovered that planting seeds and harvesting them was a lot less bother than chasing big angry mammals across the tundra? Well, agriculture has been in flux for thousands of years. Should we really be worried now? Well, the genetically modified agricultural revolution is on pause at the moment, with crops effectively banned across Europe. And currently, the same applies to gene-edited crops. And it's gene editing we're interested in today, because the UK government is trying to pass a new law which could lead to these crops being grown commercially in England. Researchers hope that gene editing might help solve global food and health problems and be more palatable to the public than GM. So will it be a game changer? Well, to discuss its potential, I'm joined by Professor Kathy Martin, group leader at the John Innes Centre, where she's leading a research project creating tomatoes which boost the body's vitamin D. Hello there, Kathy.
Hi.
Brilliant to have you. I'm also joined by Guy Poppy, Professor of Ecology at the University of Southampton and formerly the Chief Scientific Advisor to the Food Standards Agency. Hello there, Guy.
Hello.
Brilliant to have you both here today. Kathy, let's start by talking about your work with gene-edited tomatoes. It was all across the UK media earlier this year. Can you remind us what it is that you're doing?
Well, plants are pretty poor sources of one of the, what is called a vitamin, it's actually a hormone, but one of the essential vitamins, vitamin D. And with more and more people adopting plant-based or plant-rich diets, of which I thoroughly approve, it's become clear that vitamin D insufficiency and vitamin D deficiency are huge problems, particularly in Northern Europe and in the UK. And we have estimated levels of insufficiency of about 65% of the adult population. So this was conveyed to me some years ago by Sue Lanham-New, who's professor at the University of Surrey and who works on trying to improve vitamin D sufficiency in the mass population, because it's associated with greatly increased risks of major health problems, not just mineral retention and bone deformation, but also with depression, dementia, Parkinson's disease, and internal cancers as well. So Sue persuaded me that it would be a really good idea to try and get a plant source of vitamin D, particularly vitamin D3, which is more effective than what you can get from fungi, which is vitamin D2. And so we set about trying to generate plants, and our original intention was to do this by genetic modification, because it was a very complicated thing to try and do. But about 6 years ago, a paper was published which suggested that actually it could be achieved, or at least we could increase provitamin D3 by gene editing in tomato. Solanaceous plants are a special case, and this seemed like a really good thing. So to try, and as we'd failed to get any funding for the GM version, I decided that we would do it anyway. So just go without funding and try and do it. And basically, that's what we did. So we were able to edit one gene and increase the... So this gene in tomato is responsible. It codes an enzyme that converts provitamin D3 or 7-dehydrocholesterol to cholesterol. And by blocking the activity of this enzyme, we were able to increase the levels of provitamin D in tomato.
And you've been doing outdoor field trials. Can you tell us where you're up to? What's the stage of the project at the moment?
So one of the crazy ideas that came out of having made these, and of course we do all our tomato work in the greenhouses because in the UK it's not very easy to grow plants outside. But one of the kind of crazy ideas that came out of having made the pro-vitamin D enriched plants was you need exposure to UV light, which comes in sunlight, to convert pro-vitamin D three to vitamin D3, and this happens in humans as well. You need about half an hour a day exposure to sunlight in order to make vitamin D in your own body from pro-vitamin D. So the crazy idea was, well, maybe we could get away from having to think of a processing step in production of tomatoes and UV exposure. Maybe we could just try growing them outside, and like a human, the tomatoes would be able to make vitamin D3. We absolutely don't know the answer to this, and so it was absolutely essential that we should be able to grow them outside. And I asked my Italian collaborators, because I think the UV quality is better in Italy than it is here, whether they would be able to do it. And of course they said, well, it's going to take us 2 years to get permission. But this conversation occurred 2 weeks after the law changed in the UK to allow field trials by notification of DEFRA. And so we notified DEFRA, we had all the plants that qualified as QHPs, which are qualifying higher plants. So they had no foreign DNA in them anymore. And we were able to get notification in 2 days. So now we're doing the tests to see whether we can get around the processing step of UV exposure to make the vitamin D.
Okay. Now, the key distinction here is that this is gene editing rather than genetic modification. What is the difference?
Well, there is a difference in that the qualifying higher plant has no foreign DNA in it. That we use foreign DNA that encodes genes that make the mutation precisely in the plant, but we get rid of all of the foreign DNA that was used to make that mutation by a process called segregation. So although it's inserted into the tomato genome, the progeny, because of Mendel's laws of inheritance, the foreign DNA can be segregated away. So the progeny that you get with the mutation that you have created have no foreign DNA in them anymore. And people get anxious about, well, it was made with foreign DNA, but you can't really use this as an objection because the plants that you generate as a result of the editing process have no foreign DNA in their genome. So it doesn't matter what happened in the past. Segregation gets rid of the bad genes, if you like.
Yeah. And now just before we started recording, you shut the door, and because you said you don't want to hear everyone in the lab. Have you got a lab of PhD students right next to you working on this right this very second?
Yeah. Yes. So we're interested in enhancing the levels of other vitamins. So by fortification. So vitamin C is another thing that's really interesting to us, and this is because I work on tomato because I love tomatoes. But
why not? Yeah.
But we found that vitamins, higher levels of ascorbate or vitamin C, can improve the bioavailability of non-heme iron. So that's iron that's in plants that is not associated with hemoglobin. And of course, iron deficiency is really, really important as well in terms of a problem, even for developed countries.
Yeah.
So we're looking at biofortification using gene editing in many different spheres, and hope that we'll be able to use this to make accelerated progress towards improving diets, particularly plant-based diets, which I'm a big fan of.
Yeah. Okay, Guy, let's bring you in here, because obviously there's some extraordinary, certainly potential going on in Kathy's lab. Now, some of the promises around genetically modified food have been pretty sensational, you know, drought-resistant wheat, bird flu-resistant chickens. What do you see gene editing as having a potential for? What sort of things do you see it being able to solve?
Well, I think the work that Kathy has described is also of great significance. In fact, I was diagnosed with a vitamin D deficiency myself. So I've done a lot of work actually on one of the big problems in society at the moment is actually not a lack of calories, but is a lack of key vitamins and minerals, as Kathy says. So the ability to modify and especially, I think, fruit and vegetables and staple crops like cereals to contain those key nutrients, you know, can have a dramatic effect. Imagine a world where you didn't have to eat five fruit and veg, and eating one provided all the benefits. You might have a much, much higher amount of society reaching that target.
Mm.
But I think when you talk about some of the other things, you know, obviously climate change is on everybody's mind, and you know there are huge amounts of efforts going on into, especially on things like rice, to try to make them more ability to cope with some of the challenges of the climate changing, whether that be to do with drought, or whether it be to do with temperatures. I mean, I think it's kind of hard to say, well, gene editing will do these things which GM couldn't, and vice versa. I mean, as Kathy, I think, described, they're both kind of processes which are part of the journey that you said that plant breeders have been using a range of tools for many hundreds of years. And the gene editing offers a sense of precision. And as Kathy described, for those people who do get concerned about foreign DNA, a way forward to remove that, but to still enable some good changes and important changes to be made. So but I genuinely think, I think this changing nutritional aspect is rather good, because many of the criticisms people have said in the past is, who benefits from this? The company selling it, or the farmers, because they use less pesticides, which in the past they've told us are fine. So why now saying reducing less pesticides is good when they've told us that it was okay before? Or you know, higher productivity, etc. You know, me, the consumer, what do I get from this? But as Kathy kind of said, if you eat a more plant-based diet, but you're lacking key nutrients, the ability to eat those kind of plant-based diets and perhaps reduce your reliance on animal-based intake is for you. You, the consumer, benefit, and I think that's good.
So can we put this...
Can I?
Yeah, go for it, Kathy.
So I do think that with the biofortification, particularly with vitamin D, I mean, vitamin D supplements, people say, well, why don't you just take a supplement? But, of course, you get a lot more from a tomato than just vitamin D. You get vitamin C, you get fibre, and most of the people... Well, it's the biggest consumed fruit in the world, so you get it in lots of products that that all people eat, so ketchup and pizza topping and so on and so forth. And I think that also, if we're thinking about the future need for vitamin D in terms of supplements and fortification, you know, the government's actually looking at the free vitamin D supplements that were given during COVID to the vulnerable, and thinking about whether we should increase our fortification programs. And if you look at the level of insufficiency in the US compared to the Europe and the UK, where we don't fortify anything like as much, we're going to need to have a lot more vitamin D. And it would be really great if it was sustainably produced by a primary producer rather than a secondary producer, which is where it comes from at the moment.
And you know, a small change in one of the world's most popular or most consumed foods ends up making a large impact. I get the point of
yeah,
that.
But can
we put this in some sort of context, Guy? Is gene editing already being used at a highly developed level elsewhere in the world? Have there been any major successes?
I mean, it's used right across the world. I mean, in fact, China is investing very dramatically in this area, see as an opportunity to address many of the challenges they face. It's perhaps less frequent to see successful commercial applications.
And why is that, do you think?
Well, I mean, one, most technologies take a while to go from the research stage to full commercialization. I think Kathy alluded to the fact that there are countries in the world, you know, we as part of the European Union had some regulatory hurdles involved. But I think, you know, the fact of the matter is that now, because the regulatory aspects are being tailored appropriately, and the research is more advanced. You know, CRISPR-Cas9 has won the Nobel Prize now, and lots of people kind of are using it. I think you will see kind of the speed of applications increasing dramatically. I mean, one of the areas which particularly interested me, and I wrote about a couple of years ago, and relevant in the Food Standards Agency actually, is allergenicity, in which many foods people are allergic to, especially a kind of nuts being a classic example of that. And in complex supply chains, it's quite difficult to remove certain contaminants which might got into that supply chain. In fact, the way we ship products around the world in tanker ships, it's quite hard to show that you haven't got, say, carryover of soya into a wheat shipment. And the ability to use gene editing to remove the allergenic component in a product so that you kind of really reduce the likelihood of it being kind of affecting a hyperallergenic person is quite dramatic. And you can you imagine, and we're talking about sort of two children in every class now are allergic to some form of food, and their parents have to tolerate labels saying this may contain traces. And, you know, that's not that helpful. So I think the ability to address something like that, so that it would be proper supply chains with, whether it be soya or nuts, which don't have the allergenic component, you know, could be quite game changing.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kathy, let's consider public perception. You know, the gene edited still has the word gene in it. So how have you found the reaction to this? Do you think public opinion has changed, or are they as afeared of gene edited as they have been of genetically modified?
I mean, personally, and I was involved in the Royal Society Mori research looking at public perception in the UK of GMOs, I think that the case for the public being against it is a bit old hat, really. Most of the people that I talked to on the Mori poll, and I was there as an advisor, didn't really have a strong feeling one way or another. They went to look up what the problems with GMOs might be and came back with Terminator technology and things like that.
So was it? Is it mainly a tabloid headline rather than a reality, do you think?
I think it is, and it's something that's promoted by pressure groups trying to prevent it. But I just remember a classic response to the GMO question of a lady in Downham Market, I think it was, who said, well, if it will mean that my cabbages don't have caterpillars in them, I would be really happy. So that was the kind of... But I mean, of course, we all eat things at the moment that are produced involving GMO crops. So animal feed is almost exclusively GMO soya. And the EU had a zero tolerance of GMO soya, and it dropped it because we couldn't feed animals in this in Europe without it was just so expensive. So they, under pressure, they allow us to import soya that is GMO soya for feeding animals, and many of the products that come from soya will be coming from GMO soya produced in the States. Of course, they're not allowed to grow GMO soya. And anything that is genetically modified since they went on an embargo, and so those things that had gone through regulatory procedure were allowed to go on, but they didn't renew any licenses. I think the problem is that the GMO stuff was driven by multinationals, and it was about ag industry traits, and so the public couldn't see what was in it for them. And I think the change with gene editing is that it's not driven by multinationals, and there's lots of scope for innovation and SMEs. And also, I think there's a real interest in developing consumer traits. So from someone that's interested in food, we can really do stuff. So I think that ag industry isn't interested in consumer traits largely. So I think that that's very liberating. And I hope that by producing, biofortified foods, and also by improving the sustainability credentials on much of our agriculture, then the public will appreciate this. I mean, I think there's always a problem with a nutritionally enhanced food that you've got to have a grower trait associated with it to get it grown. I mean, so that's one thing that will limit that particular development. But with the vitamin D,
when you say grower trait, can you explain what you mean by that?
If you make let's take golden rice, for example. What makes golden rice feasible is the fact that the seed are given away free. If a farmer who is in the Philippines or wherever finds a cheaper type of rice to grow, that's either cheaper to produce because it's lower input or cheaper in price, because it's no longer free, he will grow that one in preference. And so you've got to have something that means that it will be grown as well as it's being good for consumers. And that's a big issue in terms of how do you get something out there. I mean, or else you increase the price, and that's really a problem as well.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Vitamin D fortified tomato, give us another couple of pence on per kilo, I guess. Yeah, I mean, it would make sense to me.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm quite pleased with the vitamin D story, because there is a producer trait associated with it, and that is that you can use the waste from cultivation, which is absolutely enormous, and you can make extracts of pro vitamin D from the waste.
Ooh.
So through the circular bioeconomy, you can give some value back to the producers. So.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Okay, so Guy, let's get back to the consumer perception. So the worry about GM plants was that that novel biochemical processes may have wider impacts. There's an unpredictability to it, and that there'd be issues that we just don't know. Much like alien plants, like Japanese knotweed and American skunk cabbage, and all these concerns. Now, do these concerns, whether or not the reality is there or not, do these concerns still affect consumers when you apply them to gene editing? Is the perception still the same that you're fiddling with our food? It's the classic, the Frankenstein food thing issue. Does the consumer still have the same view of the phrase gene editing?
Well, I think it's pretty hard to answer that in such a black and white way, to be honest with you. I think several of the points that Kathy raised are very important, and in form of any risk. And I had a PhD student study this once. The concept of trust is very important as to whether people will accept something or not. And it's interesting, scientists coming through the COVID pandemic, I think science had a period of which its trust was dramatically increased. I'm not sure that's maintained itself. And you can also see the benefits side of things coming into it. The fact is that the AstraZeneca virus vaccine, which many of us had, was a genetically modified chimpanzee virus. Mm. And most people's concerns about that didn't focus in on that. It was to do with the speed of the regulatory process and those types of things. But what you're looking at there is the fact that people can see an advantage to themselves in relation to the risk that they might be slightly concerned about. And I think Kathy's dead right. In the early days, people said, you know, why should I take any risk with this new food, when effectively there is no benefit to me?
Yes.
Whatsoever. The first genetically modified tomato puree was actually deliberately lower price, which incentivized the public, to buy it prior to the World in Action program, which, you know, led to kind of the concerns, etc. In that. But coming back to your question, there are some real benefits associated with the precision. Some of the scientific concerns about genetic modification were often to do with the imprecise nature, which actually led to it being a technology which actually you could often do it many, many times before you're successful in getting what you wanted at the end. And obviously gene editing is much more precise than that. The aspect of many of the things that you might be wanting to do, as Kathy described, is somewhat, you might argue, tweaking the natural process in a way which some random plant breeding could possibly end up with, possibly unlikely, but could, and then you breed from it, means that, you know, again, in some people's eyes, that is much more closer to things which might be possible through such, you know, through less intervention than kind of the scientist playing God, as some people might call it. So I think there kind of are aspects there, but the one thing that perhaps does, I think, raise its concern is, I think, the fact that, you know, all of these things need to be considered as safe, and what we're proposing here is not kind of throwing away any rule book and just allowing a free-for-all for people just to throw things out there, which, you know, that concept hasn't been considered.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Kathy,
I just wanted to interject on that. So, just in that context, I'm certainly don't want to advocate any responsibility. And I was advised by Robin May last week that the pro-vitamin D enriched tomatoes would have to be considered as a novel food, which is okay by me. I think that that's absolutely right and proper. So, the risks are always associated with the trait, and not with a technology. That's the important thing to, and this technology, I mean, everything with GMOs was evaluated on the basis of the risks of the technology, but we must look at the risks associated with the trait. And in the case of the vitamin D tomatoes, it is new, and therefore we need to look at bioavailability and also any possible side effects of doing this.
And that's a really important point, actually, because one of the huge differences between Europe and places like North America in regulation was that in Europe, the situation was that it was what's called process-based regulation, so that effectively, depending on whether it is GM or not GM, the regulatory process was different. Whereas in countries like North America, that they rely on what's called output or outcome regulation, in which, you know, it doesn't really matter how you did it, is the end product fine. And it, on another but related issue, that's where a lot of the arguments about chlorine washed chickens being imported into the UK are about. It's not to do with the difference in the safety at the end, it's to do with the process of reducing the amount of bacteria in the chicken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, there's a regulatory framework to this, and this, the bill is currently going through the UK Parliament, which could lead to the sale of gene-edited food in England. Some people would argue it reduces European food safeguards, which have been working well. I mean, that's up for discussion, I guess. And that if the science could prove itself, those safeguards would allow this tech into the world. So why is there any need for new legislation, Kathy? Is the current regime too restrictive?
Yes, I mean, I think absolutely, because I sit on the European Technology Platform, Plant European Technology Platform, and they're lobbying very hard to get gene editing with a lighter regulatory burden. If you look at the results of the regulations that are in place in Europe, there has been nothing come through for GMOs at all since the rules changed. And the ECJ ruling means that there would be no gene-edited plants able to come through. And you can see that the European legislation is not working, because they had to already relax the rules about imports of GMO soya, because it was, you know, it was just so expensive for us to buy imports. So now we're allowed to import GMOs, but we're not allowed to grow them in Europe. And I think for gene-edited plants, which could occur naturally, and some of the things that they want to have already been produced by natural processes. It's just that you can cut down the amount of time that you need to breed the finished variety using editing. Then this is really essential. You can't say, well, we shouldn't change anything at all, because European and UK breeders and producers will be out of business, because so many countries in the world, I'm including countries, India and Africa, have already accepted gene editing with a lighter regulatory burden.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Guy, I mean, is agriculture ignoring the bigger issues here? I mean, when we talk about things like this, I mean, there are very important issues to change, like farming practices that reduce soil quality and reduce variety and pesticide use and things like that. I mean, should agriculture really be looking at issues like that first and fundamentally saving its skin rather than getting bogged down in diet and survival?
I mean, it's a very important point, and actually, my feeling is it should be looking at all of these things, and there is no doubt that the food system, which is something which I'm interested in, from the moment you grow something to the fact it then ends up on somebody's plate and they eat it, as demonstrated recently in the UK by Henry Dimbleby's National Food Strategy, and then more recently the DEFRA-led response to that. It needs fixing on many levels. The food system around the world is making the planet unhealthy, and is actually making us unhealthy. And gene editing and technologies like that have a role in helping. But you know, the gene edited products that Kathy describes, you know, don't address, say, the junk food mile of takeaway shops in certain environments of deprived socioeconomic communities, who basically, if you don't start addressing that, then there's a hidden part of society who will always struggle to have a healthy diet. So just as is the case actually in agriculture from many years ago, having a range of tools in your toolbox is what's really useful. Gene editing can do things, and like I said, we know that fruit and vegetables and fiber are really important in your diet. We know they make you healthy, and we know that they will actually make the planet healthier by actually effectively the way those things are grown, and their carbon emissions and these types of things are slightly lower than many other things, and therefore it would be good for the planet too. However, we know that very few people eat that amount. That isn't true just for society at large. We know in demographics, very few young people eat five a day. Very few old people eat five a day. The tomatoes that Kathy described is absolutely wonderful, and the concept of what we might call health by stealth, putting better nutrients into products that people readily eat, is a good one. But on the other hand, there's people who perhaps don't like those or whatever. And that's why I think the key thing here is we shouldn't abandon this or say all these bigger, more important things to look at, because too often in this area, there's people with agendas. There's people who want the agenda of pushing it all about technology, or the people that want to push the agenda that's all about organics or biodynamics and these types of things. And the fact is, what we should be focusing on is the end system. You know, what do we want? What do we want agriculture to produce? What do we want the kind of foods to be available to people? How can we kind of incentivize or make it so that people, right from growing to selling and eating foods, you know, are more encouraged to do the right thing? Technologies like gene editing have a very, very important role, but so do industry, the government, the public themselves, pressure groups, etc., to kind of begin to identify what sort of change that you know, we need. And if you take something like single-use plastics, where you got a dramatic change almost overnight, you know, it was a combination of small fiscal aspects, Blue Planet, David Attenborough, Michael Gove, a whole range of people beginning to say this is wrong and not very sustainable. How are we going to get out of that? It wasn't somebody coming along, as has done, and said, "Oh, let's place plastics with, you know, shellfish, you know, the shells from shellfish and make a kind of, or seaweeds and make a kind of alternative to single use plastic." It needed all these things to happen to enable that to be a viable option.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense. Now, can we just step back from the discussion of the minutiae, but the impact currently, but look at agriculture in a sort of more of a historical context. Kathy, I mean, agriculture has always been in a state of revolution since we first started planting things. You know, Jethro Tull's improved seed drill was a late stage of agricultural revolution. You know, it's always been in flux. When we've come now to the concept of gene editing, and I mean, let's mention genetic modification as well, is there a fundamental difference in the tools that we're using now to cause problems to the countryside? I mean, we've been choosing the variety that grew best, the variety that was resistant to brackish water anyway. We've been changing our agriculture. The England that we know, that a patchwork of fields, is not a natural thing at all. That's not the natural state of our countryside. Should we be fundamentally worried on a different level now that people like you are gene editing?
No.
I've asked the wrong person this one, but why not?
I love the countryside, and I worry about some of the changes that are necessary in order to be able to feed ourselves. I think I worry more about being able to feed everyone and to be able to that they have access to healthy diets. Those are probably more of my priorities, but you know, I see as a fundamental problem the changes that occurred in the 1970s in the US. Richard Nixon was worried about the price of food going up, and so he basically took off all the subsidies and focused on selling corn and soya to Russia because they needed it. And that meant that the farmers didn't have to worry about excesses. Then after that, after the Russian demand fell out, then there was a real pressure to, they had excess corn and soya, and that was the junk food, the start of junk food, because it's really, really cheap. Farmers couldn't rely on subsidies anymore for growing a food basket. They grew corn and soya. That was the only thing they could make money on. And that is the root cause of a lot of our health problems now. I think that it's, we don't get enough vitamins, minerals, we don't get enough fiber for sure. And I think the price of food is a little bit low, especially for fruit and vegetables. And I would like to see some economic solutions, some economic sustainability put in place for things that are good in our diet now, whether that fits in with overall, but I think very important is economic sustainability for healthy diets for everyone, not personalized nutrition. I'm not a person that believes it. I want the people in Liverpool, in the estates in Liverpool, to be able to get access to fresh fruit and vegetables, which I know when I was a student working with families in Liverpool, the healthiest thing you could get from the shop was a yogurt, not even a low fat yogurt. That was what you, and a chip butty. So we really need to look at what is generally available and within the range of people, especially with a new cost of living crisis coming.
Yeah. So, Guy, would you agree with that? That you know, as part of the continuing agricultural revolution, regulation, politics, and economics has become a big pressure on agriculture as a whole.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, agriculture or all parts of the food, they're a business like anything else. So then, it kind of needs to be a viable business. And Kathy described a situation which, at the time, may have been seen as the right decision, but has kind of led to consequences, which we see. And in fact, one of the things that I find interesting now is with this huge talk about plant-based diets, which I think is very, very important, you know, there are some unintended consequences of that. One is the micronutrient deficiency, which Kathy describes very well. And the second is if you produce a lot of plant-based products, but in the current way that businesses make money, if you talk to most clinicians, they say that plant-based products that you see in the supermarket shelves now, very heavily advertised, are the junk foods of the future if they're largely ultra-processed with lots of other things in them. So we do need to kind of think long and hard about, you know, what we eat, how we eat it, you know, how it comes to our kind of our dining aspects. And the economics is really interesting. I mean, I might slightly disagree with Kathy a little bit. I'm not sure exactly what she was saying, but most of the economics kind of says one of the problems about increasing the price of food is the people who are most deprived get hit the hardest by that. And that's why some of the kind of strategies that have been put out there talk a lot about perhaps rather than subsidizing the product itself, you actually offer vouchers to the people who would benefit most from them. The problem is whether they will use them and how they use them.
Yes, and if they're going to food banks, they're not going to get fresh fruit and vegetables. That's another problem.
No, that's right. That's right. But some people say, you know, the subsidising fruit and vegetable, which I'd very much like, but the fact is potentially benefits the worried well more than the people who really do need the fruit and vegetables to be in their diet.
Yeah, fundamental change is really what's needed. And so the government needs to look to its food reports a little bit more closely, one might say. Brilliantly put, Guy. So just one last question then for Kathy. What do you reckon? How long before I might be able to eat one of your tomatoes, and how keen will the retailers be?
I think I'll send that back to FSA and say how long before. Well, obviously there's a long way to go, firstly, to get a good processing method so we can convert it from provitamin D to vitamin D3. So that's a lot of, we need to do bioavailability studies, and we need to take all the data to FSA and say, do you think this is acceptable as a novel food? So yeah. It's not going to be this.
And then there's the years to get a novel food accepted as well.
No. Guy can probably advise on that, but I'm sure.
What do you reckon then, Guy? How long would it take?
That is a tricky question. I mean, what you can see is regulation can happen incredibly quickly. Look at the AstraZeneca vaccine. There was no shortcuts made in that. It was more a question of prioritisation. What you might see is a lot of other things, their regulation is slower because everybody was working on that regulation.
Yeah.
With the novel food, I do think in the early days it might be longer than you'd like, because effectively you're trying to develop a new system here which has learnt some aspects of GM, but perhaps, as many people argue, that has perhaps lots of things which are just not necessary.
Well, I have some experience of GMO FDA notification in the US with the purple tomatoes that we do. And this has taken me 14 years. So I hope it will be less than that.
Yeah, no, I would hope it'd be less too. And one of the things I think regulation has to learn from is, I think, learning from kind of the information that's been gathered so far, so that you actually kind of focus in on the really key questions or the key data that you need to have in addition, rather than considering everything as a separate submission. And again, I think the vaccination aspects have shown that rather well, in which the AstraZeneca, I know I keep quoting it, but the fact is part of the speed was enabled not just by the regulatory processes and obviously some of the clinical trials are going, but the kind of huge consideration of the vast bank of information they had behind lots of the technology which was underpinning that. Now, okay, it was driven by a real need, so therefore people said, you know what, this benefit's so great that, you know, I will perhaps relax some of my risk appetite. But on the other hand here, I think we should learn from that. Same with the mRNA vaccines, which are the first vaccines using mRNA technology. But the fact is, one would hope that kind of we now focus in on what else do we need to know, rather than start from scratch on everything and let's take 14 years to decide it, when actually you might turn around and say, these are the key things I need to know here, and you need to get me those.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, basically, if you can both stop yakking with me and get on with it, because I think that there'll be a massive upside once this does get approved, hopefully, but obviously the correct steps need to be taken. Kathy Martin and Guy Poppy, thank you so, so much for talking to me today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslife.com. For example, to find our series shining a light on the many varied jobs available within the food sector, just go to the site and search Career Conversations. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.